This is a theory that will unify quantum mechanics and general relativity. And what I want to do in this talk is understand how we can unify one of the central features of quantum mechanics, which is entanglement, with the fundamental symmetry of general relativity, which is general covariance. And to see what we can, by combining these structures, what can we learn about quantum gravity? So it starts with a puzzle proposed by Jacob Bekenstein. He asked, could we violate the second law of thermodynamics, the law that entropy always increases in the universe, just by taking something which has some entropy, like this cup of coffee, and chucking it down a black hole? Okay, so the resolution he proposed to this paradox was radical, which was to think of a black hole as a thermodynamic system, as a system that has a temperature and an entropy. And he resolved the paradox by saying, well, the entropy of the black hole would increase as the black hole grows. Okay. So it was a radical idea, but it was really solidified with the work of Stephen Hawking, who showed that black holes actually radiate. They actually have a temperature. They radiate at the Hawking temperature, which is inversely proportional to the mass. Okay. So smaller black holes radiate more. For black holes we see in the sky, this is an incredibly cold temperature. The size of the radiation, the wavelengths are about 50 times the size of the black hole. So it's not an effect we expect to see, but in principle, it's there. And we should think of black holes, therefore, as thermodynamic systems. And they obey the first law. When we throw things in, the black hole grows. Its energy increases. Its energy is given by its mass, of course, in terms of the equation E equals mc squared. Okay, and therefore, if it has a temperature, its entropy should increase. Okay, so we infer that black holes have an entropy, and what is their entropy? It's given by this famous Bekenstein-Hawking formula, okay, which is the most amazing formula, I think, in all of physics. It has you know, everything in it. It's got the speed of light, it's got Newton's constant, it's got gravity, and it's got, most importantly, it's got an equal sign. This isn't like a squiggle, it's actually, you know, we actually have a number here, which is, I think, you know, amazing. And we can calculate 3 times 10 to the 69 bits per square meter. Okay, so what does this mean? It looks like we have some kind of a phase space or something of the black hole that it's tiled by little bits. And you can draw these sort of pictures that it looks like, you know, you have these sort of on and off bits and they're somewhere down at the Planck scale. Okay, so usually in physics, entropy is the volume of some, or the logarithm of some phase space volume. Okay, so what is this thing? What is this huge entropy? Okay, what's the phase space that it counts? Okay, and while it's enormous in terms of a numerical value, it's also much smaller than you expect. If you just took a gas and you imagined that, you know, each sort of independent region of space was a little, you know, bit of that gas, then you would expect it grows like the volume, but it grows like the area. So why is that? Okay. So I want to argue that the reason is entanglement. So this is not a new idea. It was proposed, I think, first by Raphael Sorkin in the 1980s. Okay. And the idea is that the inside black holes radiate, they have pairs entangled near the horizon. Okay? And there's these entangled pairs, and one of them's inside, you can't see it, one of them's on the outside, they're entangled. Since they go all the way around the horizon, they're all local, and you can see that they naturally scale like the area of the event horizon. Okay, so that's very suggestive. But entanglement's not only useful for these fundamental questions about quantum gravity, it plays a role all over theoretical physics lately. Okay, so in string theory, the latest thing is ADS-CFT. You have a field theory in 4 dimensions, and it's equivalent to a theory of gravity in 5 dimensions. And what entanglement does there is, as Ryu and Takayanagi showed, is that entanglement in this boundary field theory is a probe of the bulk geometry. It tells you something geometric about the shape of the space-time in higher dimensions. You can also use it as a renormalization group monotone. You can calculate something from the entanglement entropy that tells you how your theory changes as you change the energy scale. Okay. you can rule, and it allows you to rule out, you know, could my theory, you know, have come from this other theory at some higher scale? You can say, you know, yes or no, it could or could not using entanglement. It's been shown to be a probe of confinement in QCD. If you look at the entanglement of a region in QCD and you adjust the size of the region, you see a phase transition right at the QCD scale. And it's an order parameter for topological phases. So topological phases in condensed matter are these phases of matter that aren't described by the usual paradigm of order parameters as local observables. In order to understand them, you have to think about how they're entangled. There are these very non-locally entangled phases of matter that can be used to store quantum information. Okay. But there's a problem with this. All of these examples I just described have local symmetry. Okay. Local symmetry is, you know, an ubiquitous theme in the last, you know, half a century of theoretical physics. So for example, in ADS-CFT, the boundary theory that you're talking about, it's a gauge theory, it's a Yang-Mills theory with a gauge group SUN, and in the correspondence, you take n usually to infinity. It's got a huge gauge symmetry. Suppose you are interested in the question of renormalization. You want to know whether the standard model could have come from something else at higher energies. Well, of course, the standard model is a gauge theory, so you need to understand entanglement in the standard model. If you're interested in confinement, you're talking about QCD. It's an SU3 gauge theory. And these topological phases, even though they're ordinary spin systems, have been shown to have emergent gauge symmetry. Yeah.
This confinement issue, is there an independent field theory understanding where this is the case, or is it just some holographic that the brain falls off?
Good. So initially it was discovered in the context of holography, which allows you to do the calculations much more efficiently and to discover this effect. But recently there have been lattice gauge theorists have gotten interested in this question and have, you know, done serious simulations of it. And you know, they draw plots and you see it drops off. It does exactly what you would expect right at the QCD scale. Yeah, it's a
strong coupling expansion.
No, in the usual thing you do where you have to tune and fix, you know, things by the to fix the gap. You know, it's the usual way that you simulate lattice gauge theory. They're trying to describe real, you know, SU3 real QCD on a lattice, the way that you calculate, you know, spectra of things for, you know, to predict for the LHC, right? It's the same.
But is that a surprise? I mean, the theory, because it's a very dramatic phase transition, confinement transition. I mean, wouldn't one expect every property to be affected strongly?
Perhaps.
I should be surprised that the entanglement's affected, everything else is affected.
Well, I think what's most interesting about entanglement is it's sort of a theory agnostic probe of the system. So suppose you have some theory and you don't, you know, you want to, when you undergo a phase transition, you have to change what variables you're talking about. So the entanglement entropy doesn't care what variables you're talking about. If you wanted to think about something like, you know, people think usually about expectation values of Wilson loops and things like this, but if you change the variables of your theory, you know, maybe you even change the variables of your theory in a way that you don't know. You know, you could have some theory and, you know, you understand the high energy physics, but maybe you don't really understand what it's doing at low energies. Well, you can still talk about entanglement. It's a property that's there in any physical theory. So you can start to, you know, you can use this as a probe.
Would you say anything physical? Is that dependent on which variables you express it in? If it's a physical property of the theory, it's independent of your choice.
Well, but you, yeah, no, you could say that. Yeah, if you propose an experiment for how to measure it, of course, yes, that's true. But people think about things like, you know, the expectation value of some local operator, and you have to ask how does that flow from one theory to another. You know.
Charges.
Sure. I'm not claiming this is the only way to understand confinement. Certainly not. There are lots of other ways that people have proposed to think about entanglement. I just want to think about confinement. I just want to.
Why it's a surprise that entanglement should exhibit drastic changes.
I don't think it's necessarily a surprise either, but I think it's, you know, But I also, you know, I also didn't write a paper saying that, you know, entanglement probes confinement, and I, you know, I don't know. I think it's an interesting, it's certainly an interesting idea. Okay, good. So we have theories with local symmetries at all scales of physics, even in gravity, of course, we have a local symmetry, general covariance, the freedom to write your equations of motion in curved coordinates, to change the move the points of your space-time around. And the problem that I want to solve and understand is that in theories that have a local symmetry, the usual rules of entanglement don't apply. And we have to invent new rules. Okay. So these are the new rules that I want to propose, and I'm going to explain in detail why this is the right thing to do. So local symmetries demand a new approach to subsystems. You have to think about what is a localized subsystem. And I'm going to show that there are two ingredients to this. One of them is that you have surface degrees of freedom. You have new degrees of freedom that are present on the boundary that aren't part of the larger theory, and that these degrees of freedom carry a symmetry. And that symmetry tells you how regions of space are entangled together. It tells you how to sort of glue these things together. And that's a very general, structure, and I'm going to show how that emerges in theories with local symmetry. Okay. So here's a map of my talk. I'm going to start with the familiar case. I'm going to talk about a quantum scalar field where the usual rules of entanglement do apply. I'm then going to use that as a jumping off point to talk about the electromagnetic field, which is the simplest example we can think of with a local symmetry, as a local gauge symmetry. And I would like to take those lessons and apply them to quantum gravity. Well, there's a problem is that we don't have a theory here. Yet, okay, but what we need to do, what I'm going to propose we do, is that we take the lessons that we learn in quantum gauge theory and see all those structures, these local degrees of freedom and their symmetry in the classical theory. They were there all along in the classical theory, it's just we had to think about entanglement to notice them. And I'm going to argue that the methods and the way of constructing those things apply directly to gravity, and you'll see that it's really the same thing. And once you have that structure, once you have that new way of thinking about regions, I am going to argue that you have a way to talk about quantum gravity. Okay. Good. So what is entanglement? Just to review, entanglement is information about a quantum system that is not reducible to information about its subsystems. It's correlations between systems is information they have about each other that's not about themselves. So here's a canonical example. You take a spin singlet state. The two spins are anti-correlated. This one's up and that one's down. Or that one's up and that one's down. These systems are entangled, and either one of them on their own isn't either up or down or left or right or any direction. Okay. So we know more about the total system than we do about the subsystems. We can quantify that. Lack of information is quantified by entropy. And for quantum states, this is the von Neumann entropy. It's the quantity S of a density matrix that's minus trace of rho log rho. So a pure state has no entropy. Okay. So the full system is, the entropy is zero, but the subsystems have some entropy. It's log 2, which is the maximal amount of entropy you can have in a single spin. If the total system is pure, as it is here, then the entropy of the two subsystems are equal. They're both log 2. And so we call this quantity the entanglement entropy. And it's a unique information theoretic measure of entanglement for pure states. Yeah. And the key point, the key lesson is that subsystems can have more entropy than the larger system. So you could imagine a black hole that's where the universe is in a pure state, but if you only have access to a subsystem like the outside, then you should assign some entropy to it. Okay. Now the other theme is symmetries. Okay. So this system has a lot of symmetries, right? It could be up, down, minus down, up, but it also could be left, right, minus right, left. Okay? The full system is invariant. It then follows that if you only look at half of the system, it's also invariant. You could have rotated before throwing away the other system. It's the same. That determines the subsystems completely, and it tells you how much entanglement you have. It has to be log 2 because the systems are completely random. They can't pick a preferred direction. You measure them, you get 50-50. Okay. States in field theory are also entangled, even the vacuum. So here's a simple model of what a quantum scalar field looks like. You fill space with harmonic oscillators. Okay. The whole system is taken by you saying you have a state separately of each oscillator. Okay. So the Hilbert space breaks up as a tensor product, as it does for the simple spin system. You have some region of space A. You have a tensor product of all of these oscillators with all these oscillators. And the Hamiltonian has terms that couple the neighboring oscillators. They're just like springs in a mattress that make the, when this one shakes, the nearby ones shake too. And that means that the ground state is coupled, the fluctuations of the vacuum are correlated, okay, and that leads to some entanglement. How much entanglement? Well, the correlations are strongest at short distances. They fall off. The ground state entanglement naturally follows an area law, and one can show that in many examples, and it's also a rather generic property with some exceptions. Okay, but the generic behavior, for example, in a conformal field theory, you have some non-universal number that goes like the area in units of the cutoff, and you have a subleading term that encodes important information about the field theory. It's the so-called A-type central charge in the subleading divergence. Okay. So the entanglement encodes some universal information about your system. Okay. Now, this, I also want to focus, though, on this leading term. So usually, you just throw this away. It's not universal. It depends on your cutoff. But it looks a lot like the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So is there something to that? I think it's very suggestive. If you look at these two, it's in some sense it's not that far from the right answer. The Planck length is so small that it might as well be infinity, right? Because you're in a system, but that's not gravitational. G is zero. So if you take this formula, it really is infinity, and the field theory has no way of stopping being entangled at the Planck scale. It doesn't know what the Planck scale is. It just keeps going all the way down to the ultraviolet, and the entropy diverges. This is a lot like if you tried to count states of a classical mechanical system by counting the number of solutions in phase space. Phase space is continuous, so you'll just get in, if you tried to regulate it with some regulator, epsilon, and then you send epsilon to zero, you would get an infinite entropy too, because you don't know about h bar. Okay. So in order to get this finite answer, what we have to do is turn on gravity, okay, and that's one of the reasons why I want to think about symmetries. Gravity is a system with local symmetries. Okay, so how do things work in a theory that has a local symmetry? Okay, so here's the problem: in a gauge theory, the degrees of freedom, or at least some of them, are non-local. So suppose you have a charge and its electric field. Okay, you can measure the charge in this region. It's sort of something in this region, just some integral. Okay, but you have Gauss's law. The electric field lines can only end on charges. Okay, so out here, you could also just put a surface around here and measure the charge inside that region from outside. And that's a consequence of the fact that this is a constraint equation. It's an equation of motion with no time derivatives. It tells you something about the way that your systems must be in relation to each other. It doesn't tell you. It's something you have to solve before you even start thinking about dynamics. So the question is, if the degrees of freedom are somewhat non-local like this, how do we divide them between two regions? How do you think about a region independently from another entangled with it? Okay. So this way to think about it is to take a simple lattice model, much like the one for field theory. Yes? Great.
If you have no charge no electric charge at all,
yes,
would you say that electromagnetism is a non-local theory?
Yes, I would. In the following sense.
That sounds a very strange thing. The equations are completely local.
Most of the
That's
things
right.
are local degrees of freedom with constraints.
That's fine. I'm willing to accept that as a definition of local, but I think that
I just formulate there in terms of E and B and
That's
even the constraint
good.
Is local.
Okay, so
see what's non-local in the theory.
It's non-local in the following sense. If you want to construct a charged, suppose you want to construct a charged observable. You know, if you're just doing, just looking at the fermions without the gauge field, you have some operator that creates an electron. Okay. In the gauge theory, you don't have an operator like that. You can't just create an electron. That's not a gauge invariant thing to do.
But I can create a path if you've got C-.
That's true, you can. But let's think about the case where you don't have zero charge, because we're aiming toward gravity, okay? You can't construct an E plus E minus pair with, you can't create charges that cancel each other out, because gravity, you need positive and negative mass. So let's just think about a positively charged operator. That's not an operator of the theory. I know we think about it when we're doing field theory. You think about, correlation functions between psi, some charged thing, but those are actually not physical operators. If you want to create a physical operator, this was worked out by, Dirac in the 50s. You have to create the excitation and you have to create the electromagnetic field that dresses it. You have to create this with this. If you just put that there, it's not a physical thing. And in that sense, it's not a local operator. It has to change the charge, which you can measure at infinity. So, and that same property is just the same. It's the same in gravity. You can't create a mass without its gravitational field. Good. So that's why I want to think. That's why I say it's non-local in that sense. The equations of motion are local, just as the equations. If the constraint is local, it's all local equations.
Right.
But if you want to think about gauge invariant observables, which is an essential thing. Pardon?
They're also local in E&M.
In E&M, they can be. Some of them aren't. And in gravity, none of them are.
Well, you're saying that you're attaching a Wilson line to infinity or a charged particle?
Yeah, exactly. You have to attach a Wilson line, or you can do something more symmetric. So Steve Giddings and I have thought about how to attach Wilson lines to particles, in QED and in gravity. And, this is one way. This is one approach. Okay. It's not the approach I'm going to take today, but I think it's, it's one that has a long history of constructing local, non-local diffeomorphism invariant operators, and people have tried, and it's hard. There are these very non-local things. What do you do? So I'm going to propose a different way to handle things. Okay. Any other questions? Great. So it's useful to have a simple lattice model of what's going on, just like this model of coupled harmonic oscillators. And the Hilbert space of electromagnetism has a more subtle structure than just a bunch of harmonic oscillators coupled together. Okay. On each link in the lattice, you assign a degree of freedom, which is the phase that an electron would get hopping around the lattice, like an Aronoff-Bohm phase. And that's some unit complex number. You have an electric field, which is quantized in units of the fundamental charge. And these two things are a canonically conjugate pair. In fact, the system is really just quantum mechanics on a circle whose radius is 1 over the fundamental charge. So here's the system. You've got a phi and a conjugate E, and you put those at the links of the lattice. Okay. But we're not done yet, because there's still Gauss's law. It's a constraint. It is a local constraint equation. It restricts the Hilbert space. And so let's consider the case without charges. For simplicity, you have some electric fields coming into some point, and they have to add up to 0. Okay, so that's some operator in your theory that depends on 4 electric fields, or more if you're in higher dimensions. And it's also a generator of gauge transformations. So you impose this, you impose that your states be gauge invariant, that Gauss's law has to annihilate the states. And that leads to a Hilbert space structure that looks like this. It's a tensor product of all the Hilbert spaces of all those individual edges, all those quantum particles on circles, but with a constraint, you mod out by the gauge transformation, or equivalently, you impose Gauss's law. You make the electric fields match, And because of that constraint, the Hilbert space doesn't factor in the usual way. It's not just a simple independent electric field at every link. So what do we do? Well, this is the most democratic thing that you could think of doing. You've got these degrees of freedom that live between region A and B. Well, we cut them in half. Okay, so we now have two edges. We have half in region A and the other half in region B. Okay, and we define what you might call an extended Hilbert space. Okay, it's all these oscillators on, they're quantum particles on a circle for all of these edges in A, even the ones that stick into the boundary. And you mod out by some of the gauge transformations. You impose the constraints on the blue vertices, but not on the orange ones. So you don't impose it at the boundary. Gauss's law on the boundary would say that the normal electric field vanishes. Okay. Now this thing, of course, contains new degrees of freedom because you've reduced the gauge symmetry. So we now have a phi on here, this circle-valued thing, and we have a circle, and we have its conjugate momentum. It's the perpendicular electric field and one extra phase for every point on the boundary. Okay. This space has a large symmetry. We've got a bunch of circles, one at each of these orange points. So we have a freedom to rotate them. Okay? And what rotates them? Well, it's the electric fields sitting on these links. Okay. And that is a symmetry of this extended Hilbert space that's not a symmetry of the larger theory. And we have its generators. We call this the surface symmetry group. And it acts on the Hilbert space non-trivially. It's the product of the group at all these orange vertices on the boundary. Okay. So now how do we stick? We've defined what we mean by this local system, and how do we stick them together? So if we just took the ordinary tensor product, that would contain states where on this link you have one value of the electric field and on that one a different one. Well, that's not a state of your original theory. That violates Gauss's law at these points. So you impose Gauss's law. Again, you take the tensor product of these two states, tensor product of these two Hilbert spaces, and you require that the states satisfy Gauss's law along S, this bounding surface. And that is equivalent to taking a quotient of this surface symmetry group, acting on this sort of diagonal piece that acts on both A and B. And that just amounts to matching these generators. Okay. So the symmetry that you have of these new degrees of freedom tells you how to combine subsystems together. Okay? It tells you you don't just take the ordinary tensor product, you have to take the tensor product, and then you have to divide by this symmetry. Okay. Now, symmetry tells us a lot about how states are entangled. Okay. So the states of the larger Hilbert space are invariant under this symmetry group, just from the definition of this quotient, and that just follows from gauge invariance. And it follows, just like in the example of the spins, that where the larger state was invariant under a rotation, that tells us a lot about how these systems are entangled. We have some set of generators of this symmetry. They all commute in this case of electrodynamics. And so you can simultaneously diagonalize all of them. Your density matrix breaks up into a sum of sectors. Each sector corresponds to a different choice of boundary conditions for the perpendicular electric field sticking in. And within each of those sectors, you have a separate density matrix. So you have a probability of having that particular configuration of boundary conditions. And you have, for each set of boundary conditions, a density matrix. Okay. And one can, once one has a form of this density matrix, you can calculate. Okay, I did, and what happens is it breaks up as a sum of two terms. There's a term that is just the classical Gibbs-Shannon entropy, whatever you prefer to call it, of these fluctuating boundary conditions. We don't fix the boundary conditions, they fluctuate, and there's some entropy associated with that. And then there's another term, which is just there's some ordinary entanglement. There are local degrees of freedom here that can be entangled with local degrees of freedom elsewhere. And we just average that over the boundary, over the boundary conditions with the appropriate measure for our state. So that's a certain lattice way of regularizing things. It seems kind of natural. Is it the right answer? And yes, we've checked it. So these surface degrees of freedom, it turns out, are actually important. They're very important. They make up an order one fraction of the entropy. They make an, so we have, these are the sort of systems where this definition has been checked. You know, we looked at the toric code, which is the most sort of canonical example of one of these topological phases. And there it turns out that this term is, in fact, 100% of the entropy. Okay. Electrodynamics in 2 plus 1 was checked. It has some properties that you would expect, like duality to it. So this theory is dual to a scalar field, and you can check how the entanglement transforms under the duality. And one can even look at electrodynamics in 3 plus 1, as I did with Aaron Wall. And what you find there is that if you want to calculate the subleading term of the entropy, the one that gives you the central charge, it turns out that this term, which nobody had calculated before, makes up an order one fraction of the central charge. So before people were calculating this and getting answers that didn't agree with this general result for conformal field theories, that, you know, the central charge, which you can just look up in a book, and the entanglement, which you could calculate, they didn't agree until we added this. So this seems, this simple idea of extending the space seems to be the right thing to do, and it generalizes to non-abelian gauge theories as well.
Do
yes?
Do they agree now, or is it order one?
No, they agree. These are two numbers. So this was like, I don't remember the exact numbers, it was like 62 over 90 and 30, you know, and the actual central charge was 32 over 90, maybe Rob knows these. People did calculations like, J.S. Dowker did a calculation. He's a very serious guy who, you know, he calculates partition functions on curved spaces. That's just what he does. And he found, you know, he tried to calculate this and he got a number that didn't agree with his central charge. And then, so we came along, we did this, you know, fairly naive thing of looking at a lattice and adding up the, you know, adding up these extra boundary degrees of freedom. And what we found was 1/3, and we added it to Dowker's answer, and we got the central charge.
Why do you say order one?
Sorry, an order one fraction of the entropy. That's what I mean. The entropy is huge, of course. It's like divergent, and it's not
subleading.
You mean 50%?
Yeah, exactly. It makes up, you know, this is 1/3, and this is some other order one fraction. It's, yeah. Of order 50% in these cases, or of order 100% in this case.
You're basically saying without this correction, you don't get the right answer.
Exactly.
And then you get the right answer.
Exactly. That's the message. Okay?
If the claim this is independent of how I choose to set down the lattice and how I choose to perform the lattice?
That's an excellent question. I think that's something worth checking, and it's something that we're thinking about. So for example, you know, there are these theories with dualities, right? You could write in terms of the electric potential or the magnetic potential. You know, is the entropy the same? You might think, okay, if it's the same theory, it has to be the same. So good. Yeah, and you might be worried. It turns out that it does, up to some calculable correction. This is work in progress. And the reason is the following. Suppose you have not just the electromagnetic field, you have a potential too, right? That's a measurable thing. You can measure phases, you know. Yeah, right, exactly. And when you map between the electric potential and the magnetic potential, you have to solve some equation, right? Some non-local equation that gives one potential in terms of the other. So the notion of locality in the two theories is not exactly the same. And so one might expect that they'd be different. So you've got two arguments, one that says they might be the same and one that might be different, so we're calculating them, and we want to know. Yeah, so that's an excellent question. Thanks. But yeah, it's still work in progress. There are some examples where you calculate on both sides and you don't get the same answer. Like this toric code is dual to an Ising model. and those don't. The Ising model is not topologically ordered, and the toric code is. So there's some non-local property that transforms non-trivial inner duality. But we could talk more about that later. Yeah, good. Okay, and the Rolle de Sault generalizes readily to non-abelian theories as well. The only difference, really, is that the electric field lines that you have now transform in non-trivial representations. There's some factor associated with the fact that a quark has these gauge indices, these internal degrees of freedom. Okay, and you have to, and those always come in maximally entangled states, and you have to add those in. Okay, and it seems like you might be over, you know, it sounds like you're overcounting. You're counting all these different colors of quarks. Aren't I, you know, shouldn't I not be able to distinguish between colors of quarks? And yet, this is the right thing to do. So it's been checked in a lot of examples. Lukowicz and Maldacena considered quark-anti-quark pairs accelerating away from each other. They have to have some non-abelian electric string between them. And there's an entropy that comes from the non-abelian electric string. Okay. Myself and others have calculated in Yang-Mills in 1 plus 1, which is a very nice, you know, almost topological theory that's exactly solvable. And you can check that this gives you exactly what you would expect in that theory, including these boundary degrees of freedom. And it's been worked out in 2 plus 1 Yang-Mills as well. It's much harder to do. It's a, you know, it's a non-abelian interacting theory, but you can carry out the calculation at weak coupling, and it does what you would expect entanglement entropy to do. Okay. So these are all checks of this, that this is a sensible way of defining entanglement. In fact, it's the only sensible way I know of defining entanglement. So, great. So what can we learn about gravity then? Well, I can't just write down for you the Hilbert space of quantum gravity and split it up in the same way because we don't know what that is. We have some models, like loop quantum gravity, for example. It was the first thing I tried, try to, you know, take these spin network states and cut them up and glue them back together with entanglement. But you know, there's a problem. You need to solve the Hamiltonian constraint. There are a lot of issues there. We really don't have the full theory yet. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a detour into the classical realm and show how these phases and the electric fields show up in a classical theory, just straight from the action. Okay, but first I need to remind you a little bit about classical mechanics. So obviously I can't talk about Hilbert spaces and entanglement in a classical theory. So what do I have to talk about? It's a phase space, okay? A phase space is just this, all this, the space of solutions to your theory. It's not just a set of solutions, it has an important structure. You have Poisson bracket. I'm going to encode it in terms of this symplectic potential. It's a function of some space, some point in the space, and a vector. It's a one form, okay, in the phase space. And it's just P delta Q. Okay. And that encodes all the structure of classical mechanics in a very nice covariant way. We're aiming towards GR, and we want to be as covariant as we can. So what does theta do for you? It relates symmetries and conserved charges. It tell you know, if you want to know how do I you know, what's the operator that translates Q, it's P, you know. It tells you what's physical and what's gauge. The gauge transformations are the things whose generators vanish. It determines your Poisson brackets, which will become commutators in the quantum theory in some appropriate limit. And perhaps most importantly for our purposes, it tells you the density of states on phase space. So in the phase space, this PQ plane is effectively broken up into little cells of area 2 pi h bar. That's how you count states in a phase space. Okay. So this theta is our key object for understanding subsystems in the classical theory. So let's think about electrodynamics now in some region with a boundary. Okay. This has we constructed a Hilbert space for it. We can construct a phase space for it. Okay, and we have a symplectic potential for this theory. It's just the integral of some vector field, okay, called little theta. And for electrodynamics, it's just given by F mu nu delta A nu. Okay, what does that tell us? Well, this is P delta Q. It tells us that we have canonical variables. We have a vector potential, and its canonical momentum is the electric field, just as we had on the lattice. Okay. So here's the issue. If we want to think of that the gauge invariant phase space, then theta has to be gauge invariant. But here, so a gauge transformation transforms A, keeps F the same, but here's theta, it depends on F and A. So let's do a gauge transformation. We shift A by this derivative, okay? And then we move the derivative over using the equations of motion, and we have a total, this total derivative term. And so we have a surface integral in our symplectic potential. Okay, so this surface integral, it's the normal electric field times the variation of alpha, our gauge parameter. And that's something that you can't have. If you want to do classical mechanics, your symplectic potential has to be gauge invariant. Okay, so we have to eliminate this. Here's what everybody does to eliminate this term. You impose boundary conditions. It's a very natural thing to do when you have a finite system and you want to evolve it in time. Okay. So you might say, oh, let's just set the perpendicular electric field to zero. Okay. We mustn't do that. We must resist the temptation because we would undercount the entropy. There's an order one fraction of the entropy that's coming from the fluctuations of our boundary. And so we can't impose boundary conditions. Indeed, when you're thinking about entanglement, you want to be thinking about, you know, some region of space that's just here in the middle of this room. It doesn't satisfy any boundary conditions. It's just a region. Okay. So we don't do that. But then what do? Well, we take our inspiration from the lattice and from these surface degrees of freedom. So here's the key idea. We introduce this U1 phase, okay? Something that gives us effectively a reference system for the gauge symmetry. And this allows us to extend our symplectic potential. We add this boundary term that depends on phi now and on the electric field. And how do we determine this extra term? Well, it's determined by gauge invariance. We perform a gauge transformation. This term on the left picks up this boundary term. And this thing also has a term that cancels it off. Good. So now we have a gauge invariant theta, and we can talk about a subsystem. Okay. And theta, what does it do for us, right? It tells us what are the physical degrees of freedom. Well, according to this theta, from the point of view of the subsystem, this phi is physical. E perp is, of course, physical. It always was. But now we have its canonically conjugate partner. Okay. So now we can build a phase space, right? And what phase space do we get? Well, we can calculate Poisson brackets of these things. That's the other another thing that theta does for us. Okay, and they're they're exactly the commutators of our original thing. They're phi and the perpendicular electric field. Okay. It also tells us what's physical and what's gauge. Well, I said that already. And it also tells us the generators of symmetries. So we have this circle, and we can rotate it independently at each point. And this tells us again that the generator is E perp. Okay. So we have the key ingredients that went into defining a quantum subsystem and talking about entanglement. We have some surface degrees of freedom, and we have a symmetry. Okay. Now the same structure is present in classical gravity. Okay. And perhaps that's not surprising. Gravity is also a theory with local symmetry and with constraints. Okay. There are four constraints, the Hamiltonian constraints. There are the equations of motion without time derivatives that if you're doing general relativity and you want to construct an actual solution, these are the equations you have to solve first before you even start evolving them in time. And what's their role? Well, they're responsible for the force of gravity. Take the Newtonian limit of slow velocities, of weak fields, and one of those constraint equations becomes the good old Poisson equation of gravity. It says that things fall. Okay. But it's also one of these constraint equations that tells us regions of space aren't independent. And we can treat this in the same way as in electrodynamics. How? Well, we had this nice covariant construction of classical mechanics, and it works as well in gravity. Okay. So we have general relativity. The fundamental field is a metric, g mu nu. I'm going to take units where 16 pi g equals 1. And the symplectic potential is, again, given by the flux integral of some vector. And you can calculate what this vector is. This formalism has been developed for, you know, years by many very smart people. And here is one form of it. And it tells you, once you decode this equation, you know, it depends on the solution and its perturbation. It's a one form in the phase space. And it tells you that the spatial metric is canonically conjugate to some components of the extrinsic curvature. Great. But this thing is not invariant under the fundamental symmetries of general relativity, just like the symplectic potential for electrodynamics was not gauge invariant. So what are the symmetries? Well, they're diffeomorphisms that move the points around. And you can calculate how theta transforms in exactly the same way you did in the same way it transformed anomalously in QED. Okay, how does it transform? Well, just as in QED, there's a total derivative term, this d nu, q mu nu, okay? This q is Wald's another charge that he used in order to try and understand the classical first law of black hole mechanics. Okay, and then there's a new source of anomalous transformation, which is that theta is a vector field, it's a local vector field, and it has some diffeomorphism transformation law. You have a vector over here, you pull it back by the diffeomorphism, you get a vector over here. Okay, and rotate it. Okay, so we've got two things. We've got theta transforming just because the points are being moved around by this diffeomorphism, and we have a boundary term, which we have to cancel. Okay. So what do we do? Well, we introduce something that's like phi. Okay. It's something that transforms in a particular way under the gauge transformation that allows us to specify what is the subsystem we're talking about. It's a reference frame, essentially, for our subsystem. Okay. What is a reference frame for gravity? It's a system of coordinates. So what we do is we add some system of coordinates, x mu, that comes, you know, from some, say, reference system, R4. We have some map into our manifold. The relativist will point out that coordinates usually go the other way. This is more like the convention you use for a string world sheet. Anyway, the point is we add this extra dynamical degree of freedom, x mu, and that's our gravitational analog of phi. Okay. So, and now we play the same game. We look at our anomalous transformation law, and that determines for us what our boundary symplectic potential will be, what our boundary term has to be. So there are two sources of non-invariance, and now there are two things you have to do. One is that this surface can move around, okay? So we have to keep it fixed. We don't specify this system over here that moves around under transformations. We fix it in our reference, in our frame of reference, okay? And now we integrate the flux over here, over this surface, x of sigma, and we integrate the boundary term over its boundary, capital S, which is x of little s. Okay. And then we add our surface term, which cancels out the boundary term that we had from this guy, and that's again given by Wald's another charge. Okay. And this whole thing together is diffeomorphism invariant. So now we have a phase space, and we can actually an actual physical phase space. Okay.
Great. Including changes of x or nothing?
Good. I'm going to get to changes of x. Okay. So we have surface degrees of freedom. Okay. Theta tells you what's physical and what's gauge. All of x is not physical. You can wiggle around the surface on the interior, but there's some piece of it that is. It's like phi, just like you had phi only on the boundary, you have x only near the boundary. Okay. What are the physical parts? We've got the location of the surface. Okay, the boundary of our system is a physical surface that has that you know can move. We have to specify its position, its location, and the theory tells us we also need a normal frame. So we need a pair of vectors that in the normal directions, but we only need it up to scale. Okay, and that's analogous to this degree of freedom phi that was just circle valued. Okay, so. What are the symmetries, the analogs of rotations of phi, right? This is where the symmetries of x come in. This thing acts on x, okay, in a particular way. What they do, just like you change phi by rotation, here you have to change move this reference surface around and its frame. So these are diffeomorphisms of our reference R4 that, and some of them are physical and some of them are not. Okay, So what are the things that transform our system? Well, there are three kinds. Okay, the first kind we can think of is a surface boost. What we call a surface boost, where you just change the normal frame. Okay, so you keep every point fixed, but you move all these frames around independently at each point. Okay. And those are generated by vector fields that vanish on the surface but have some non-zero first derivative. What's the second class of things you have? You can slide the surface along itself. You can take this orange point and move it here, but keep the total surface the same. So these are vector fields infinitesimally that meet the surface in a tangential way. Okay. And finally, there are translations, which I think what you were asking about. They move the entangling surface. They're vector fields with a non-zero normal component. Okay. These are not canonical symmetries of the phase space, and you shouldn't expect them to be. They're moving a physical surface. You're changing your subsystem, and that loses information, and so it's not a canonical symmetry. Okay. But we have a large group of physical symmetries. And so what's the group that we have? What's the group that governs these degrees of freedom? What are their generators? This we read directly from theta, and we calculated them. Okay. They're encoded precisely in the geometry of the surface. Okay. So we have these surface diffeomorphisms that slide you along. Okay. What generates that? Well, you have a connection on the normal, on this normal frame. It's the curvature which defines a vector in the surface. Okay. And you can look at their Poisson brackets. You also read that from theta. What's the group they generate? It's the diffeomorphism group of the surface, not surprisingly. Okay. What do the surface boosts do? Well, what are their generators? It's the metric in the normal plane. So there are three independent components of this two-dimensional metric. Okay. And they generate a group with three generators. It's SL2R. It's the symmetry group of this conformal frame. Okay. And it's the group of 2x2 real matrices with unit determinant. There's a very interesting operator in here that you can calculate. It's the Casimir. It's like J squared that tells you the dimension of the representations, how many states you have. Okay. What's the Casimir in this picture? It's the area element. So the area of the surface, the physical area in GR, is controlling the number of degrees of freedom. Okay. So these are the analogs of the perpendicular electric field. Okay. It's the geometry of the surface, and they obey Poisson brackets with the x's, location of the surface. And not only that, with each other. Okay. So you put these structures together, you get this huge non-abelian algebra. Okay. You get the diffeomorphism algebra of the surface. You get the SL2R independently at every point of S. These don't commute with each other, these don't commute with each other, and these don't commute with these. You commute these with these and you get another. You commute a diff with a boost, you get another boost. The diffeomorphisms move these boost generators around. What does that tell us about the geometry of the boundary? That's the generators of this group. It tells us that the geometry is non-commutative of a boundary in general relativity. Okay. That's the key point. We have exactly the degrees of freedom that encode entanglement in the quantum theory. They're in classical GR, and they tell us that these surface degrees of freedom that are responsible for a large part of the entropy are some non-commutative geometry. It's a real space like a sphere. Okay, so that's what we've done so far, and now I want to say how I think that's going to help us with the problem of quantum gravity. Okay. So the general idea, or an idea that's been around for some time, is that we should think of space as some network of subsystems which are all entangled with each other. Okay. That's true even just in a spin system or a field theory, and it's true in a gauge theory, perhaps. It'll be true in gravity. So many people have thought about this idea. So here's a spin network in loop quantum gravity. That's exactly what this is. It's a bunch of systems that are entangled together along these edges. Okay. Here's a mirror tensor network that people have sometimes looked at, and if you look at it from really far away, it kind of looks like the kind of hyperbolic space that you get in ADS-CFT. And here's the happy tensor network. That's a more recent, it's an error-correcting code that's also proposed as kind of a hyperbolic model of space. Okay. So you have some set of quantum subsystems and they're entangled together, but mostly there's a lot of freedom in this game. There are a lot of error-correcting codes that you could consider. There are a lot of mirrors. What are these degrees of freedom? How do we know that these things are describing gravity? They could be describing anything. We need to know what are the subsystems for gravity and how they're entangled. So what goes on the nodes and what goes on the edges? Okay, so we have a concept of a classical subsystem that's just the same as it is in gauge theory. Okay. And what you do with a classical phase space, if you want to study the quantum theory, you quantize it, right? You try and construct a representation of its Poisson brackets in terms of commutators. Okay. So that's hard. You shouldn't hand someone a phase space and say, here, quantize this. They'll tell you to get out of their office. But we have an edge here, okay? The first thing you should do is you should look at the symmetries of the system, okay? This is what you do in field theory. You look for representations of the Poincaré group, right? This is what Wigner did in the 30s, okay? And we have a symmetry group, and it's huge, and it's not abelian. And it's actually, I think it's really interesting because it's right on the edge of what people can study. So diffeomorphism groups in one dimension, you get things like Virasoro, which is the symmetry group of conformal field theory in 1+1 dimensions. It's responsible for why string theory is so, why people can calculate things in a theory of strings. It's this huge symmetry that helps us. So that's diff S1. Here, if we're thinking about our world, we've got an S2. It's the next natural thing, and we've got this semi-direct product structure. So what can we say about representations of this? Okay. So I should say we don't know yet, we haven't quantized this system, but there's some really interesting hints for the future. So first, it's a semi-direct product. It's just like the Poincaré group. So what do you do in the Poincaré group? Okay. This is this classic result of Wigner that underlies quantum field theory. Okay, so the Poincaré group is a Lorentz group, semi-direct product with translations. Here we have diffeomorphism, semi-direct product with these boosts. Okay. What's the first thing you do? You look at the group on the right, the one that's acted on, and you look for a representation. So it's a translate. You look for a representation of the translation group. Okay, in Poincaré, you open up Weinberg. That's what you do. Okay, here we have surface boosts. So you pick a representation. What's a representation? It's a four momentum. You fix some four momentum. Here, you fix a representation of this. What's that? It's an area element. It's an independent area element at every point. Good. What's the next thing you do? You rotate it to some preferred frame. You pick out the invariant quantity. It's the mass. Here, we can now, instead of doing a boost, we can do a diffeomorphism. We can change the shape of this surface, or rather, we can slide this surface around, preserving our area element. There's one invariant of that. It's the total area. So the total area is our invariant. It's the thing that plays the role of mass in the Poincaré group. What's the next thing that you do? You look at the little group. Okay? It's the things that preserve that particular vector, that preferred one. What are those? Well, they're the diffeomorphisms that preserve our preferred surface, our preserved sphere. The group of area preserving diffeomorphisms. Okay? Which is a very interesting algebra. Okay, so this suggests that something is going on where you have representations labeled by area playing the role of mass, and the APD group is playing the role of the spin group. Okay. What is the area preserving diffeomorphism group? It's maybe not that familiar thing, but suppose we have an S2. Well, it's the space of canonical symmetries of a classical phase space. It's not the usual P and Q, it's a compact phase space, it's a sphere. You can turn a round sphere into a phase space in a very natural way. Representations, what's a representation of an algebra of canonical transformations? That's quantization. So representations of these things, the thing that play the role of spins, they're quantizations of these spherical phase spaces. And how, so we know from classical phase spaces, they divide up into cells, into Planck h-bar size cells, okay? So what's playing the role of h-bar here? Well, again, you look at theta. It tells you the commutators, it tells you the Poisson brackets. Theta, it goes like 1 over g, okay? So when you look at the commutators, instead of h-bar, you get gh-bar. It's the Planck area, okay? So this is highly suggestive to me that one needs to look at this structure, that this is somehow underlying this, the fact that in gravity you have some finite entropy. It, could it be that the horizon is quantized just in exactly the same way that a phase space is quantized, the little cells of size 2 pi h bar? Okay. So we don't know yet, but I think that's the direction this is going. So just to sum up, entanglement is everywhere in our universe. It's at every scale from the Planck scale down to these topological systems, and it's even there in empty space. But we have local symmetries. So entanglement is this, you know, great theme of 21st century physics, but we need to see how it interacts with the great theme of the latter half of the last century, local symmetries, right? So I'm proposing an approach in terms of these surface degrees of freedom and their symmetries that tell you how space-time is stuck together and how quantum systems are stuck together. Okay. The surface symmetry tells us a lot about that entanglement. We have a huge symmetry to exploit that we can calculate. You know, we can calculate things with. This is proven in gauge theory. It tells you how the states are entangled. And this same structure is present in classical gravity. It gives us a definition of what we mean by a local subsystem, which has been, you know, evading people working in quantum gravity and classical gravity for decades. It gives us a way forward, I think, to understand the entropy of black holes. And I think even more broadly, it tells us how we can think about quantizing gravity. So thank you.
Questions?
Yeah.
So in this final treatment, you consider a boundary, and you consider the symmetry to the boundary, and you consider translations and rotations.
Yes.
But eventually, you want the boundary to be the horizon, right? And at the horizon, one should have these BMS-like degrees of freedom that Andy Strominger rediscovered recently.
Yes, possibly. I mean, it's a conjecture, right? Yeah, I think that's absolutely an interesting way to go. So I should say, I'm not only, while I motivated this with black holes, entanglement is not only a property of black holes, it's there anywhere. And there's no need to impose some boundary conditions that tell you you're at a horizon. You are allowed to impose further boundary conditions if that's the system that you want to study. And I think a really interesting way forward, so I mentioned that three types of symmetries, including the translations, which are local translations that look a lot like BMS. Okay, but in order to have those be canonical symmetries, you have to impose some boundary conditions, or else some information will come across. In general, a horizon is not a closed system. You need to somehow close it. Now, I think a very interesting direction is to try and close this with some boundary conditions. What are the, you know, this formalism can actually tell us, what are the allowed boundary conditions? What do you have to do at the horizon to ensure zero flux? And so there was this paper by Hawking, Perry, and Strominger, where they argued that there would be some symmetry like this along a horizon, but they just wrote down a generator and they never said what phase space they were looking in. Is this physical or is it gauge? Without any further specification, without any further construction of the phase space, you have nothing to tell you whether that's a real symmetry or gauge. And diffeomorphisms in the interior are almost always gauge. I mean, they are, you know, that's how you do things if you put your boundary at infinity. So I think this offers a way to put the boundary at some finite place, you know, impose some boundary conditions that this structure can tell us what we have, you know, what are the options, okay? And now see, okay, what does their generator generate? What are the, you know, what is the horizon BMS group? What's the phase space on which it acts? I think that's the missing element of that program. Yeah. Yes.
You said that the geometry on the surface is non-commutative.
Yes.
Could you make that a bit more precise?
uh, I can. Okay, so yeah, good. So here we are. So here's the geometry on the surface. Okay, so let me, okay. All right, good. Yeah, don't mess with the Canadian with a hockey stick. All right, so we have the generators of our surface. Okay, here's our surface. We've got a metric. We've got two normal directions, I and J. Okay, we've got, so then we've got this 2x2 normal plane metric H. We've got the induced metric on the surface S. Okay, and we've got this field A that plays the role of, if you're familiar with the ADM 3+1 split, this is the shift, okay? So you've got this generalized shift. Now it has an index in these, because you have, now you have two normal directions. Okay, so here's our explicit generators for the symmetry, okay? So here's the derivative of the normal component. That's the piece that generates the boosts. The boost generator is this guy. Like I said, it was it's related to the normal metric. Okay, I may have said it is the normal metric. Well, it is up to this epsilon, which is just the, you know, antisymmetric 2x2 symbol. And then you've got the density, which is important because it enters the Casimir. And here you have the conformal part of the normal metric. Okay, so that's the generator of the SL2R symmetry. This other thing that I called the curvature of this connection, well, you view A as a connection, and this thing is the formula that looks like the curvature of a non-abelian field strength. It has this index mu that's a vector in the surface, okay, and it also has this density factor. Okay, so those are the generators. We solved for them from our symplectic structure. Okay, and you wanted to know why they're non-commutative. Great, well, here are their Poisson brackets. So we can read their Poisson brackets just from the fact that these are actually implementing the diffeomorphism cross SL2R algebra that has some particular commutation relations. You can show that they obey this equation. You get this algebra. In general, when you quantize, there's sometimes a central charge here. It turns out in this case there isn't. And here are the Poisson brackets and their gory details, and these realize our symmetry group. And so now you calculate the Casimir. It's the determinant of the generator, this H matrix, and you calculate the determinant of this H, right? You get this, the normal pieces cancel, and you get just the determinant of the metric on the surface, the thing that determines the area element induced on the surface. Which is, I never expected going into this that you would find such a structure, but there it is. And this normal metric, let me not get into this unless somebody is really curious about the relation to some previous work. Okay, so I hope that answers your question.
I'm not sure what's more commutative about this than, say, just having a commutator between functions, some Poisson bracket that's not zero. What's more non-commutative about this boundary space?
Oh, yeah. So in the electric field case, you have these are the symmetry generators. The electric field part, the electric fields normal to some boundary just all commute. It's a completely abelian group. So yeah, in the electromagnetism case, you have U1 to the S, and that's just an abelian group. And actually, the non-commutativity is what makes it possible that actually the entropy is finite, right? Because if it's abelian, it's just like a classical phase space where X and Q and P commute. So you have these U1s, you can diagonalize them all at individual points. You have this divergence of the entropy that you have in the continuum. Okay, here you've got derivatives around. Okay, and now that tells you that, okay, I can't simultaneously diagonalize this guy right here and this guy right next to it. There's some more structure, And that tells you something, that tells you, well, you follow the representation theory, and it tells you that the thing that plays the role of the spin group is this non-commutative sphere. You need to go way beyond that. It's like, it's as if we're doing quantum field theory, and all I've done is I've told you what SU2 is. Okay, great. You still have to find, you have to find all the representations. You have to figure out what, you know, what are the physical fields that correspond to them? You have to find the scalar, you have to find the Dirac equation, you have to find Maxwell's equation, you have to find, you know, Rita Schwinger and these spin three halves things, you have to find the graviton, you know. You have to do the same thing here. You have to look at the representations. Yeah. Yes.
Could you please comment more on the physical meaning of these three type of triangles? For example, corresponds to what kind of observable we usually know in general relativity?
Yeah, that's a good question. They're observables of the bounded system. They're observables that you need to define with respect to this reference frame. But I've been arguing you need to do this. You need to include this reference frame in order to talk about physics in a bounded region. So what are they? Well, they're precisely these. They're these generators. The normal metric. And they're components of the geometry. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, so the problem with this, which is it seems a completely classical construction.
Absolutely, yes. Right. So far, it is a completely classical construction. The part we did is here.
Right.
I want to go here, but we're here.
I know, but if you think about quantum geometry, whatever that means, surely there's some kind of superposition of 4D geometries within which your surface is sitting. And the way you construct the surface is by embedding it in this single 4D geometry. So
that's right.
I don't really understand how it can possibly apply.
Yeah, so you have to look.
Study quantum 4D geometry.
Absolutely. That's the way you usually think about it. People in quantum gravity have had this thought, okay, you need to think about start with the quantum theory of the whole universe, maybe, or the wave function of the universe. There are all these fantastic ideas. I mean, I love the wave function of the universe. Okay. I'm biased because I live here, this is sort of an alternative approach, I think, you want to start with a smaller system and build it up. So if we're looking at, you want to ask, shouldn't there be a superposition of geometries? Absolutely, there should be a superposition of geometries. But what I'm advocating is that, okay, you fix some system and you break it up into, you have it decomposed into subsystems, okay? When you sort of glue these things together, the symmetry tells you, when you glue two systems together, let's think about the electromagnetic case. You start with a system with fixed boundary conditions for the electric field. Okay, you have some other, but you have to consider all possible boundary conditions for the electric field. Okay, and then you glue it to some other system. Okay, so there you might say, well, the electric field is completely, is in some sense fixed. It's one of these symmetry generators, but now you glue it to some other system, and you have to, this way of combining subsystems tells you have to match the electric fields, and now the electric field can be in superposition. So you absolutely will have something like superposition of geometries. You just want to think of the geometries in some sense, one at a time, and then consider, them separately, and then once you glue them together, you have superpositions.
So if you consider lower dimensional gravity, then probably there are more tractable models and not homomorphism group is much simpler.
Yeah.
So do you think you can get some insight from there?
Absolutely. I have, there are some very bright students at Santa Barbara who asked me the same question and were thinking about it, yeah. And I think, that's a great project. Yeah, the first thing you think, okay, I've got this crazy, I've got this crazy algebra, right? Okay, can we do something simple? Like let's consider two dimension, one plus one gravity. Okay, that's not here. Look at this. Put in a dilaton. Let's see what happens. I think that's a great place to start. Three dimensional gravity is obviously the next step. Yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of interesting questions even in, there are a lot of simple models one can consider. There's, there are lots of gauge theories we haven't thought about. There's string theory. I have a very bright student who's thinking about this picture in string theory. Yeah, there are lots of possibilities. It's a very general framework, but it's tested in gauge theory. It works. So how far can we push it? Yeah, I'm aiming toward this, but I agree. Start small. Yeah.
Doesn't the
So what role is time playing here? Are you spaced at a given time, or are they space-time type entities?
That's a good question. We should think of them as, usually in quantum mechanics, you think of states as associated with, you know, some fixed time. And then subsystems are then associated with some three-dimensional spatial regions. You want to think about, there, good. So you want to think about this three-dimensional region bounded by some two-dimensional closed surface. At some fixed time, you want to talk. I mean, right now we're constructing the phase space, the space of solutions. You know, usually you think about that as, you know, something at fixed time. But yes, of course, you'd like to think about how this system relates to the same system where you might draw the surface a little bit to the future.
So then, relating to Neil's question, you've got a superposition of geometries.
Yes.
It looks like for each one of those different geometries, you have a different region, and so then it's not clear that your subsystem is defined. Over a collection of different geometries, you need a different subsystem for each term in your superposition, which is not normally the way you do quantum theory.
Yeah, I think that may be what you have to do to give some. You know, one possible thing to look at in this model is, you know, there are various ways that you could imagine operationally fixing a surface. You have some set of scalar fields, say, and I want to say it's the surface where, you know, the Higgs field takes this value and this other scalar field takes some other value, and I want to talk about the region in there, okay? That specification of a surface transforms the way our X does, so one can consider different possibilities for that surface. Actually, this work with Steve Giddings, one of the things that we thought about is how, you know, there are multiple ways of specifying a surface if you want to make gauge invariant observables in kind of a global way, and this is a framework in which to ask that question.
Okay, but then you're trying. Oh, no. Okay, the way you draw it is dependent on a fixed metric.
No, there's no fixed metric. The metric is.
Diamonds look like they have a sort of.
Oh yeah, the causal structure. Yeah, ignore that. It's just sort of to make you think about the fact that these degrees of freedom, you know, they are. I define them in relation to this surface, but really they're degrees of. You know, it'd be the same. They don't depend on how you slice through the middle. They're really the degrees of freedom that live in some causal diamond. But you only think of them. You know, the phase space in some sense lives at one time.
Okay, thanks, William. Yeah.